You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Sir Richard Branson. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin, slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders that come to our classes at McGill. Today, I'm delighted to be in the Silicon Valley, speaking to two McGill grads, a husband and wife couple that met at McGill University, now working in the Silicon Valley. Anastasia is the founder and CEO of Minori, a minimalist makeup brand. And Tigran Karapetian serves as a director of the Production Board, a holding company that solves the most fundamental environmental problems our world faces, related to food, agriculture, biomanufacturing, human health, etc. Anastasia, tell me about your early life.
So I was born in Kazakhstan when it was still the former Soviet Union. My mother was a tailor, and my father was working for the police academy. He was a colonel. And I have an older sister who's 15 years older than me, and she immigrated to North America first, initially to the U.S., and then she actually enrolled to McGill, and that's how the process of getting our family over to Montreal started. So my mom and I moved to Montreal, my dad followed soon after, and that is how, at the age of five in 1995, I ended up in Montreal in Canada.
For your mother as a tailor, that's a fairly portable skill, but a colonel, it's not as portable. What did your dad end up doing?
So my father, being an extremely resilient, persevering person, decided in his late 50s, because he was already a little bit older at that point, to learn how to drive long-haul trucks, which was an insane career switch for him. But he, you know, he persevered. He translated the driver's manual from French to Russian word by word to learn it. This was in the pre-internet days, pre-Google Translate days. And he did, he was a driver until the age of 72. So he did it for a long time.
But that's, it just shows what immigrants give up, because he was a colonel. He was saluted when he went by. Like, that's a very powerful, important position. And ended up as a truck driver, you know, it was a humbling thing. But I guess they did it for you and your sister, effectively.
Absolutely. They did it for my sister and I. And, you know, both of us were extremely hardworking, very appreciative of the sacrifice that they made. My sister, who's a lot older than me, ended up becoming a lawyer in New York City. I was still 11 years old at the time, so I was living just with my parents. And I wanted to start working at a very early age, because to me, seeing both of them work so hard, not making a ton of money, I could not afford all, let's say, the typical things that kids in Montreal did at the time. So I started working at the age of 14, part-time jobs in the summer as a sales rep at all the stores down St. Catherine to make my own money, support myself, get myself through as independently as possible. And then that continued on, you know, while I was at McGill as well. I always kept a part-time job. And then, you know, after that, I moved over to Toronto. So seeing my parents work so, so hard was definitely a huge motivator for me to be resilient, perseverant, and, you know, work harder than anyone else.
How about your mom? Did she go back into tailoring, or what did she end up doing?
She did. So for her, it was definitely a slightly easier transition. She went from, you know, having her own atelier back in Kazakhstan to being an employee. She did alterations in Montreal for dresses and, you know, all sorts of clothes. And she did that until she retired a few years ago.
If you're tuning in now, you're listening to the CEO Series. And today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a McGill alumni couple who are living and working in the Silicon Valley. So Tigran, where are you from, and what did your family get up to?
So I was born in Armenia, also during the right before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Both my parents are PhDs in physics. You know, we grew up actually right around 93, 94. We moved to Switzerland, to Geneva, as my dad was working at CERN and was invited as a foreign scientist. And my mom joined, worked there as well. So spent 4 or 5 years there, growing up as immigrants in Switzerland, which is very different than Canada. You're not really an immigrant. It's difficult to acclimate there. It's not as welcoming to immigrants. But anyhow, we eventually, you know, since both my sister and I spoke French as a first language, you know, we decided to move to Canada, and Montreal, being French, was the natural place to move around the age of 9.
What did your parents end up doing in Montreal?
So it turns out that as a physicist, you have to do a great deal of programming to program your experiments. And so both my parents were very fluent in Fortran and some of the old languages in C. And so both of them became software developers.
Are they still in Montreal?
Yeah, both of them are still in Montreal. Both retired. My mom actually worked for McGill last couple of years. She just retired last year.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about how we get you back to Montreal, you two, later on, but we'll leave that for later in the conversation. So what did you study at university?
So I studied finance at McGill Business School in undergrad. Thought a long time of studying law, but my sister, who's 5 years older, she did law, and you know, I got a good experience watching her day to day, and it didn't seem appealing to me, so... thank for her for being the guinea pig. Decided that law was not for me. I went to finance, finished with actually the Honors Investment Management Program.
Okay.
At McGill.
What was your first job at a university?
I was lucky enough to get an internship at a hedge fund in Toronto, which converted into a full-time gig. So I sort of skipped the banking route that's more typical. Join a hedge fund in Toronto right after.
So how did your kids meet?
We met at the library in Bronfman.
At McGill then.
At McGill, exactly. So we met at school, and we've been together ever since. It's been 11 years.
Wow. So how long were you guys in Toronto?
We were in Toronto for about 6 years. So I joined Tigran as soon as I graduated.
Okay. And what were you doing in Toronto?
So my first job, I also graduated with a degree in finance. I got a job as a commodities trader. So I worked for an agricultural commodity company that bought corn, soybeans, wheat from all over Canada, the US. So I actually bought physical commodities from industrial farmers in Ontario. I met them in person. I would negotiate the deals and then sell them onto the market. I traded on the Chicago Board of Trade for a while, learned how to hedge. So it was a very, very, very different type of role from where I ended up today.
So what made you guys move to the Silicon Valley?
So we ended up moving first for Tigran's role. We made a 2-year stop in New York City.
Okay.
So we moved to New York City first, and then finally was again another job transition of Tigran's that brought us over to San Francisco. And I've kind of made my way in the beauty industry across New York and San Francisco as well. So that worked out very well for me.
So you're a commodity trader in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
How do you pivot to beauty in New York?
So I figured out very quickly that I did not want to buy corn for a living. But I loved the act of negotiating and meeting business people. So I ended up getting a job early on as a food buyer for MTY, which is the company that owns like all the fast food chains in all the food courts in Canada. And I ended up being a purchasing manager for two of their largest chains. And I learned how to negotiate every ingredient on a national scale. And I absolutely loved that type of role. But again, the industry wasn't as appealing to me. It's very repetitive. It doesn't really change. You know, chicken prices are chicken prices. You're in and out. And from there, I got the opportunity of joining a fast-growing Canadian e-commerce company, which is well.ca, which has today been acquired by McKesson. As a buyer. And I was very young at that point. Normally to become a buyer, you need to kind of go through many years of being a junior buyer. I skipped all of that because I had the background that I had from more of a finance approach. And I started buying for their home category and then eventually for their personal care category. And that is kind of how I got my foot into the door of beauty, because it was a very, very easy switch from personal care to becoming a beauty buyer. And my kind of last stint in the buying world, I joined Sears Canada in its last year before it collapsed. And
but we don't blame you.
Definitely did not blame me, but it was an amazing experience because me and another buyer got to manage $100 million cosmetics book.
Wow.
And so we were these two 25-year-olds managing the cosmetics business for the entire Sears for all of Canada. I got to work with brands like Lancôme, like Clarins, Estée Lauder companies. It was such an amazing experience for me, but it also opened my eyes to the fact of how different big beauty is versus smaller independently owned beauty brands, which I had the experience of working for in the previous job when I was still at Well.ca. And I was a lot more attracted to those smaller companies because they were way more innovative. They had a lot more soul. The founders were very personable, open, and they were the ones that were doing very exciting things in the space. So I already kind of had my eye on that path, which eventually led me to start my own company. But kind of the last corporate stint I did before launching Minori was working for Ipsy, which is the world's largest beauty subscription box company. So when Tigran moved to New York to join a new hedge fund there, I moved over to the US and joined Ipsy and became a personalization manager who was responsible for figuring out which beauty products should go to 3 million customers every single month. So I was kind of the bridge between their machine learning engineers and their merchandising team that would source all this product. And I would figure out kind of how to create the logic for the algorithm, test all the products, really understand customer preferences, look at all the reviews and try to learn how the beauty space works for this company. So that was what ended up also bringing me to San Francisco, because their head office is in San Mateo here. So it was an easy transition for me when Tigran wanted to move to California.
Today, I'm delighted to speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a couple from the Silicon Valley. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, I'll ask Anastasia and Tigran about the difference between San Francisco, the Silicon Valley, and New York, and what it really means to work remote these days. You're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a couple of McGill alumni living in the Silicon Valley. So you guys have been in Montreal, Toronto, New York, and San Francisco. This is an exam question. Compare and contrast New York and San Francisco to each other. And then secondly, what can Toronto and Montreal learn from them to up our game? So Tigran, we'll start with you. How's New York and San Francisco different?
Very different. Classic example is if you go to a dinner party in New York and you don't know anyone, let's say there's 10 people, the conversations would hover around. First of all, there would be a lot of finance people, lawyers. The conversations would hover around bonuses and markets and things of that nature, deals that you're closing. Here in San Francisco, if you go to a random dinner party, more likely there's half of the people are startup founders, people who are trying to change the world, technologists, engineers. So I would say that really is kind of a stereotype, but it's a stereotype that I've found to be true.
Anastasia, anything you'd add to that, or is that?
I think that's pretty accurate. I would say San Francisco, obviously being in California, having access to this beautiful nature, it's a little bit of a more wholesome lifestyle. And everyone that I meet here is into sports, into hiking, into traveling, and seems to have a little bit more of a mindful, balanced approach to life. So everyone wants to be successful and do really, really well, but it's not just about the money. It's a lot about kind of thinking about the environment, thinking about how to live a more balanced life, which in New York is a little bit harder to find. So New York is definitely very, very fast paced. You'll never be bored there. There's always a million things to do, but it's a little bit less healthy in that sense.
So what can the Silicon Valley teach Toronto and Montreal so we up our game, probably get you guys back, but to up our game so we can keep McGill graduates there and grow our economies in high tech, AI, things like that? What's your advice for us Canadians, as Canadians?
I think that COVID has taught us a lot. You know, there's certain good things that will come out of COVID, which is work from home, which in turn has allowed companies to become fully remote. There's a lot of these new companies, startups that are distributed. They don't even have a headquarter or an office to speak of. I think that will definitely help startup communities in Montreal to get formed, where you can get venture-backed from a California company with the majority of the team based in Montreal, or you can be a smart person from McGill who graduated, wants to get a job in California, but you don't actually have to move here. You can get a remote position. There's so many of these remote positions nowadays.
And there's a war for talent in the Valley. Is that absolutely fair statement?
I think it, especially for software engineers. I think the software engineers are the new finance bros, if you will.
Yeah, okay.
Mercenaries, a lot of my friends who are founders of startups, software startups, it's always a large complaint of how difficult negotiations have become to hire them. They're much more ruthless than they used to be in terms of, you know, how much stock am I getting, and I'm getting this offer somewhere else. So it's very much true.
So that means that I was speaking to a senior executive at Bombardier, and they had hired someone in Manitoba and someone in Nova Scotia to work for them in Montreal, but they were going to stay in their cities. And if you're in Manitoba or in Nova Scotia, it's not a bad thing to go to Montreal every couple of months. Like, you go, you know, go enjoy it, restaurants, festivals. This is a nice part of my job. But maybe this is an old person question, but when I was at IBM, I would schmooze the boss, I would manage the boss, I would get to know people, I'd work my way up. How do I do that if we're never in the same room practically?
I think any founder who's trying to build a culture inside an organization has to struggle with this, because you cannot replicate the water cooler conversation that people have. I think that's one of the main downsides of this new model of work, is it's really difficult to build interpersonal relationships between employees that goes beyond the Zoom call and goes beyond work. It's difficult to talk about personal stuff on a Zoom call and really build that relationship.
If you're tuning in now, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a McGill alumni couple who are living and working in the Silicon Valley. So a bit of travel is going to be required. And I know one company said, a friend of mine runs a company coaching ourselves, interview will be out shortly, and they one day a month, they get together and do things. They're all in Montreal, but it's, you know, they're doing stuff to develop that teamwork or maintain the teamwork in their case. What's your thought on where the world's going to go with this?
I think the world will never go back to how it was before. I think that is definitely clear to me. I think that technology will step up the game of bringing people together. Who knows what the metaverse is going to bring us in a couple of years. I do think that travel is resuming, and hopefully people will meet up in person. But I do think that we might have to learn how to develop a little bit of that networking aspect with people that are in our city that are not necessarily in our companies, and take that to our advantage. So, for example, in my space, I've met a lot of other founders in the beauty industry that live in San Francisco, that live in Los Angeles, or even in New York whenever I travel there. And we network, we meet up, we have calls together, we have coffees together. And that is very similar to, you know, what I would have experienced if I was working, if I had, you know, a team of 10 people physically next to me. And I encourage my employees, my interns, to do the same thing. I'm like, you know, you have to meet the people in your surrounding to learn from them, because it's definitely very different than spending an entire year within a big company where you can, you know, knock on the door of someone more senior and
you guys both did this for years, so that
we did.
Okay. What are you up to these days, Tigran? What are you up to? What are you doing?
So I work for, I joined 6 months ago, a holding company called The Production Board, and we're a venture studio, which is sort of the new model that I think is still in experimentation mode in, to some extent, but it's become much more popular these days, which is to say that venture capital, rather than backing founders after the companies are formed, they would essentially come up with a thesis for a company internally. And then once a thesis is developed and feasibility studied, they would go out and find the right person to come and run it and give them a split of equity. But thereby doing insource or taking all of the operation, the hiring, the scaling up, fundraising functions away from what a typical founder would have to do, such that the founder only focuses on the thing that they do best, which is in our case, deep tech or ag tech, food tech, is R&D work. So most of our founders are technical PhDs who are incredibly good at what they do, but they don't know how to go fundraise, or it's not their core skill set.
Who comes up with the idea? Is that you guys or the PhD?
It varies. Sometimes it's us. Sometimes it's a scientific paper that comes out where technology is always built on the shoulders of giants. So it's never one revolutionary. It's a combination of things where a new thing comes out that allows something else that already existed, like CRISPR, to all of a sudden you can create a third thing. And so we would have these periodic discussions with our advisors or internally with our technical staff, where our own internal R&D team. And then we would, you know, really run through these hypotheses and see if there's a business there.
Cigar in Montreal is doing something similar. I don't know if you've ran into them.
Diagram, yeah.
Diagram,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's part of Cigar, but yeah, that's for
yeah.
Okay. Part of they've done is hire ex-McKinsey and BCG people who do industry analysis and kind of look at it coldly, rationally, analyze and say, this is what's missing. But then you don't have the founding story of Uber, where they're in Paris is the story, and we can't find a cab at 3 a.m, and why can't we do this on our phone? I think it's a true story, but some founding stories that it's probably, you know, artfully put together at times. So it's not that because my heart goes and I go, I can't believe I'm so frustrated. It's we've intellectually looked at it, coldly analyzed it in the warmth, you know, in the cool of the day, and said, there's something that the world could use.
The most important question that any smart venture capitalist will ask a startup that closes the door to try to raise money is the why now question. Which I think wasn't necessarily as much the case at the time where Uber and some of these Airbnb was founded. The difference between then and now, 10 years or 15 years later, is there's such a prevalence of funds. There's so many teams that if there's a good idea, someone would have already done it. And so that brings the question, why is it that someone hasn't done it before? So you have to have a why now answer, good answer. And it can be something where behavior of consumers have shifted, new technology, new regulatory framework, but it has to be something. And I think that competitive dynamics around startups has shifted so much, has become so much more intense that in my opinion, is going to be more rare going forward that you hear those stories with Travis Kalanick or these founded something in my garage. I think that's something of the past. In the future, I think it's going to be actually probably a lot of venture studios, which methodically come up with something that has a high chance of success.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a couple from the Silicon Valley, two McGill grads. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll ask Anastasia and Tigran why the Silicon Valley is the startup ecosystem it is known as today, and also hear about Anastasia's company, Minori, a makeup company from the Valley. You're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a couple of McGill alumni living in the Silicon Valley. The Silicon Valley, we're in the center of the universe for startups and things like that, but New York, a lot of stuff going on, Toronto, Montreal, London's got a lot. We see this in Singapore. So it's not Singapore's lost its mojo, it's that other cities have copied it to some degree. Is that true, or am I getting overstating my case a bit?
I think it's true. I think as far as the value of being in San Francisco is not as high as it was before COVID. And back to my point before, here it used to be that you need to go through Sand Hill Road, do all the rounds to raise money. Now you can raise money through Zoom calls. In fact, most founders prefer that because they don't have to travel. I do think, however, that there's something to be said about networking and this kind of density of smart people. And I think San Francisco retains that in certain fields. I mean, New York is, as far as fintech, New York is definitely the king right now. But for, you know, more traditional software, you know, YC is still here, Y Combinator. Yeah. There's a lot of incubators here. There's a lot of institutional knowledge, know-how, and most of the VCs are still based here. But that being said, there's no reason why this can't be replicated in Montreal, in Toronto, in Singapore.
But there's a critical mass here, and there's Stanford and Berkeley. We have McGill and so on, but U of T. But Stanford and Berkeley, they've just got a long tradition of ideas coming out of their professors getting involved and students. And so there's an ecosystem there that is wonderful.
Definitely. I mean, Berkeley in particular for biotech, synthetic biology, electrochemistry, a lot of the startups are coming out of deep tech. They have to have a lab with instrumentation to be able to go and test and develop their prototypes or run their experiments. And Berkeley Lights has all these tools. I mean, if you're a student there, you can access them. And the same goes for MIT for biology. That's the other hub for biotechs is MIT. And that is something that cannot be as easily replicated. You need to really create this ecosystem that allows startups to really tap into the resources of universities for you know, modest amounts.
If you're tuning in now, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a McGill alumni couple who are living and working in the Silicon Valley. One last question for you. We'll get to the startup, the real entrepreneur in the room, is that when people come to me with ideas in Montreal about something they're trying in Canada, I go, I got to believe there's someone in Australia, the UK, in the Valley that's got the same idea. Why don't you reach out and find out who they are and exchange ideas with them? Now, you got to take care, and there's a student of mine, a former student, who's doing law tech from Japan and one in Montreal. So I said, would you guys get together? And there's a bit of danger, but it seems like the old model of world domination, becoming the Google, the Facebook of the world, Jeffrey Moore's crossing the chasm kind of stuff, that we're now saying grow to a certain size and get bought out or do global alliances. Is that a way, do you see that? Is that reasonable advice for them?
I think it depends on what kind of business you're or what kind of area you're operating. If it's a winner takes all market like Uber or Lyft, yeah, then you have to go for blitzscale and go for scale because your marginal cost being lower than the next guy is what will ultimately determine your success. But if you're building, you know, a great example is Goodfood, you know, Neil Cuggy. They, you know, took what Blue Apron did successfully in the US, replicating Canada. They were first to market, and their goal was to be the Blue Apron of Canada. They surpassed all expectations. But in that business, it's more of a local logistics, marketing. You need to know your customer. You need to build partnerships with the grocery stores, et cetera, et cetera. That is not a winner-takes-all market. That's more of a let's be good operators and let's run this business properly.
But it's something where it strikes me as, what are they doing in Australia? Like, you phone from Canada and say, we're doing something similar. You don't compete with each other, but you can learn from each other and say, let's do a monthly call and just say, what are you up to? Here's what we've learned. Maybe it might be useful for you. Do you see people doing those sorts of things from time to time?
I think in the field of science, which is really where I operate all the time. I mean, research flows very easily through a Zoom call. Academics sell all over the world. The largest probably investor in the food tech space right now is Temasek and GIC from Singapore, but most of their investments are in Europe, in the US. They sponsor a lot of the largest synthetic biology, alternative protein startups, and so they definitely have a global mindset.
Well, it's funny, I was in Singapore about 6 weeks ago and met with them. Mm-hmm. It's a small world out there in some ways. Okay, let's get back to the entrepreneur. So, Anastasia, what is the name of your company and what does it do?
So the name of my company is Minori, and it stands for Minimalist Origins. And Minori is a minimalist makeup brand. And essentially what we specialize in is creating the best possible everyday essentials that are useful, that have clean ingredients, that are very easy to use, as multi-purpose as possible, and that work on all skin tones. And Minori really came out of my desire to declutter the space, because the beauty industry exploded over the last decade. A lot of companies went into the space, and the rise of social media made it such that everyone was watching a ton of YouTube and all of a sudden decided to collect giant collections of beauty products, but at the end of the day, they're not using them. And in all of my years of working in the beauty industry, the biggest realization for me was that women prefer a much more natural look. They do not put on a ton of makeup in the morning when they're getting ready. And if they do put on makeup, they'll put something on that is very subtle and natural and complements their skin tone. But when you walk through a big beauty store like Sephora or an Ulta, 60% of what you see out there is trend driven. It's really intense colors. It's not necessarily products that you will wear on an everyday basis. So I saw the need for creating a brand that solely focuses on everyday essentials, that tries to make them as good as we possibly can with the best formulas, with the best clean ingredients, and removes that choice overload from the shopping experience.
So it's, where did the decluttering thought come from? Didn't you read one of the Japanese artists, one of the Japanese authors about this?
Absolutely. So I actually discovered Marie Kondo when I was still living in Toronto. I was a little bit of an impulsive shopper back in the day because I, as I mentioned, grew up with not a ton of things in my childhood. So I overcompensated for that lack by constantly buying new clothes and kind of home decor and all these things that I didn't necessarily need in my early 20s. And at some point after like several years of this type of behavior, I was realize that this is not making me happy. I'm not feeling more fulfilled in life by owning all these things. My apartment is starting to look very cluttered. And I decided to explore an alternative way of living, an alternative way of buying things. And I discovered Marie Kondo. I learned how to declutter by reading her books. And this opened up the gate into a new world of learning about minimalism, learning about mindfulness, eventually learning how to meditate and appreciate the beautiful things in life that are actually not things. And that is the philosophy that I'm bringing into the beauty industry. I think that we are all trying to focus so much more on our well-being right now as consumers. We're all trying to be healthier, happier. And oftentimes that is not solved by, that next impulsive purchase. It's solved by finding better balance in your life. So if you are making an investment and buying something, you should buy fewer, better products. You should do a little bit more research before buying them. Ideally, buying from brands that align with your values. So a lot of Minori's customers love the fact that we're a female-founded brand. They love the fact that we're vegan, that we're cruelty-free, that it's a small company, that's a company that takes time to do a lot of research before launching a product. So that concept of decluttering and becoming a more mindful consumer is something that I experienced in my 20s, but I see collectively right now as a society, we're all experiencing that same need of shifting our consumer patterns.
When did you found the company?
I founded the company 9 months ago, so that is when we launched. It took a few more years to develop throughout the pandemic, where I was slowly making the steps to launch it.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a couple from the Silicon Valley. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll ask Anastasia and Tigran whether they're more introverted or extroverted. Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a couple that are living today in the Silicon Valley. Right now, we will continue our conversation about Anastasia's makeup company, Minori. Is it all online or do you have a store?
So I decided to take an omnichannel approach. As an ex-buyer, I saw a lot of value in working with retail partners. When you're a very young startup like Minori is, with very small marketing budgets, you want to reach as many customers as possible where those customers actually shop. In our case, I decided to reach out to one of the best clean beauty retailers in the United States called The Detox Market. I built that relationship with them 2 years even prior to launching. Like this, we secured launching with them. And then we got into Hudson's Bay online. We just launched at Indigo in Vancouver. We are in about 20 other independent shops across the US and Canada. And we just launched at Anthropologie.com, which is very exciting for us. So you can find Minori both in stores, on other companies' websites, and obviously on our website.
How many employees are? How big is it?
The company right now is very, very lean. It is, I work full time on Minori, and we have a social media manager. We've had some interns help us out across the last few years. But yes, we're very, very lean. And it's very typical of beauty brands. Even the biggest beauty brands in the world, you can take a look at, for example, Kylie Cosmetics, which sold for an insane amount of money. It was a team of 12 people. So eventually when we grow and we raise more money, we will hire more employees, but it will likely kind of stay in the 10 people realm.
And you have suppliers producing the products for you. You don't make any of the products yourself.
Exactly. We work with a contract manufacturer and you basically go to the best laboratory that makes the type of product that you want to make. In our case, everything is produced in the US. But in the future, let's say if I make a lipstick, the best lipsticks in the world are made in France. If you make an eyeliner, the best eyeliners in the world are made in Germany. So you have to learn your supply chain very, very well early on.
Well, you spent years at that. So great background, obviously, for that. If you're tuning in now, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with Anastasia and Tigran, a McGill alumni couple who are living and working in the Silicon Valley. What is your next big growth step? What's the next big thing?
Our next big growth step is really becoming experts in e-commerce, learning how to acquire new customers in a cost-efficient way. I think that the e-commerce space has really, really shifted in its approach over the last 30 months. If before companies would come in and they would just pour $20,000 into Facebook ads per month and they would generate a very, very high ROI on that, there's been a lot of changes with the privacy rules that prevent Facebook from targeting customers as well. So right now, the challenge that every single entrepreneur in e-commerce faces is learning how to growth hack. How do you reach customers organically at a much more efficient, in a much more efficient way? So that is definitely, something that we're working on every single day.
Is social media a big part of that these days?
It's a huge part of it. It's how 90% of our customers discover us today.
So TikTok, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, what's the ones that work best for you?
Instagram is definitely the strongest one for us. We are working on becoming pros at TikTok as well. And I would say those are really the two main ones. You can do a lot of stuff on Pinterest as well,
yeah.
But kind of Instagram is where you make the biggest impact.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
You know, it's a very difficult question for me. I think I'm one of those few people that is right down the middle.
So an ambivert.
An ambivert, exactly. I think that I love talking to people in a business setting. I will be very outgoing with friends as well, but I love spending alone time. I love reading. I love meditating. I love being at home by myself. And I do get quite exhausted after a very strong, big social day.
How about you?
It's funny. I think I've shifted over the years. I was probably more of an introvert in you know, high school, became more of an extrovert as time went on. Definitely get energy from social interactions.
You guys are young millennials. Are Zs a bit different in terms of their view of the world and so on? Do you think Zs are a little bit different than millennials like yourself?
I think that they're extremely aware of the importance of protecting the environment. I never heard the word thrifting when I was growing up. And right now, that's all what the Gen Zs talk about, and have a very, very different approach to buying things, to supporting brands.
What is thrifting?
Exactly. It is buying secondhand clothing because it is very wasteful to purchase new clothing, which often end up in the landfill. So small things like that, Gen Zers are very cognizant of it, and it's a very exciting generation to watch grow up, because I'm curious to see the type of companies that they will found.
Yeah, I think from a value standpoint, Gen Zs are definitely, they grew up in the setting where, you know, they basically had the mobile phones when they were 10. I had my first mobile phone when I was 20. and so, you know, Facebook had just started, and so definitely they grew up in an era where, you know, social media was very critical to their social life and to the way they made friends and maintained friends. And I think that also reflects in their values, in that they're, on the one hand, they're more real, they seek authenticity, they shun kind of big corporations. They're more skeptical around what people say, or companies or politicians. I think they're just more thoughtful in a lot of ways. But in other ways, they're also, you know, people, a lot of CEOs would say that, you know, Gen Z employees, it's an adjustment to onboard them. They're more vocal about their needs. They're more vocal about what they need to find meaning in their work, versus millennials. I think we're sort of, you know, in between the Gen X or the baby boomer generation, that we're more ready to accept work that was given. Just that's you need to do this. Versus now, I think even Goldman Sachs had to put mandatory weekends, because the Gen Zs were just not okay. Even the high powered A-type Gen Zs, at some point they wanted to know whether this comps table I'm building on Saturday at 11 p.m., whether that's actually going to be used or it's just another pitch deck that's going in the garbage bin. And so I think that's another thing that really is different for Gen Zs as employees as the other generations.
What book are you reading right now?
Let me give you the exact title, because it is an amazing book and probably one of the best that I've read on the topic of mindfulness. And it is called Living Beautifully by Pema Chodron, who is actually a monk who lived in Canada for a long time. And it is a book that talks about the way that we see uncertainty, and uncertainty being such a big part of human nature, right? We never know what tomorrow was going to bring. We never know as business owners what today will bring. And how do you cope with that? How do you see that? And it's a very much of a Buddhist kind of viewpoint on that.
Tigran?
The book that I'm just finished is called Range. I think it's David Epstein is the author. A very interesting book about how it's sort of the rebuttal to the 10,000 hours thesis by
Malcolm Gladwell.
So the main premise of the book is how generalists are going to rule the world as opposed to specialists. And he provides a lot of examples. Each chapter is around a new example, but at a high level is this connecting the dots where you need to be multidisciplinary to sort of see the forest from the trees, especially when it comes to product development, when it comes to R&D. You know, oftentimes the people who make huge strides in biology were chemists or physicists, people who were not deep into the nitty-gritty of, you know, DNA and sequencing and things like that, but they were able to connect the dots between three different technologies that someone who was specialist would not have connected. And, you know, the best example of that is, of course, Elon Musk, who's able in his head to integrate five dimensions of different areas of science and business. And I think that book really does a really great job of explaining, you know, this wicked world, as how he calls it. Generalists really thrive as opposed to a more, you know, fixed world, like playing golf, for instance, where Tiger Woods started playing golf when he was three. That really served him well. Because it's the same swing over and over again. But in most business contexts, it's an ambiguous world where there's uncertainty, and that was a fascinating book.
So you're using the ideas at work, I think.
The ideas at work?
No, of Range.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely speaks to me because I'm not a biologist or technical person, yet I found myself, you know, before the production board, I was working at a biotech company in strategy for 2 years. Here I'm navigating between different areas of science. But, you know, the concept of knowing enough just to be dangerous is definitely something I've become familiar with, where I find that you walk into a meeting with PhDs and as long as you can follow the conversation, it's interesting how you having a perspective more on the business side, or also having seen a lot of different things but at a high level, allows you to come up with different perspectives and different conclusions and insights.
This is the CEO Series. Thank you for inviting me into your beautiful home in San Francisco, Anastasia and Tigran. It was a pleasure to sit down with you. I would also like to thank our show producer, Gabby Hartshorn-Mell, our technical producers, Marco Campagna, and our script writer, Stephanie Richet. And finally, to our listeners, à la prochaine.